Howdy. This is a fuck.
Welcome to the fail.
No. I got this. All right. Welcome to the Art of the Fail. This is a podcast hosted by Christian Borgazan, co-founder of Bruja, and myself, Chris Buttonham, co-founder of Obi.ai. We chat with startups and entrepreneurs about their failures in hopes to uncover incredible lessons and unmask the stigma around failing today. Nobody likes this shit. Let's just get started with the show.
All right. Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of The Art of the Fail. I'm super pumped for today's episode and today's show. We are joined by, as always, an awesome guest, someone who is an active inventor, investor, and if I will, an evangelist for the ecosystem, Sanjay Singhal of
author.
Yes, author too. Sorry, I forgot to include that.
Zero to Tesla.
Sanjay Singhal of 500 Startups and Audiobooks. Sanjay, welcome to the show.
Thanks, guys. Happy to be here.
Yeah. Thanks, Sanjay.
You're welcome. So as Chris mentioned, we like to kind of kick things off with what we call these, quote unquote, rapid fire questions. They're not so quick sometimes, so I don't really like using that term, but it kind of does fit. And it's just a series of 6 to 8 questions that I have on my phone right now. Let's get started. What did you have for breakfast this morning?
Okay. Now I have to think about this. What did I have for breakfast this morning? Pretty sure I had something. Must have had something. Pizza. Yes, that's what
pizza
it was.
Pizza for breakfast.
Oh, that's a new one.
I opened the fridge and I thought, it was either that or a samosa. And the pizza looked better. And then my son came into the kitchen and said, "You having pizza for breakfast? Can I have some?" His mom yells over, "No, get away from me." Yeah, I had pizza.
Awesome.
How many cups of coffee or tea do you drink in a day?
I don't know, typically zero, unless I really need a boost, but I drink a lot of Coke Zero.
Okay, so, Coke Zero is the drink of choice.
Three of the little cans.
Yeah.
Coke Zero.
Then. Okay.
Yeah. Awesome. Your alarm clock goes off. Do you hit the snooze or do you get up right away?
What do I do? I don't hit the snooze,
okay.
But I typically will turn it off and then lie there for 5 minutes and then get up.
That's a lot better than myself. I'm a snoozer probably 5 or 6 times. It's terrible.
Right.
iPhone or Android? I'm guessing by the earbuds that you have in there, iPhone.
iPhone. I tried Android.
Yeah.
Actually tried it for 3 months and just I couldn't stay on it. Had to come back.
Which Android?
It was the Moto X at the time. It was a beautiful phone. Loved the phone. But just the ecosystem is pretty good on Apple.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm with Android right now, but I'm about to make a switch back.
How dare you?
To iPhone. I don't know. I'm not really liking it that much, to be honest. Anyways, when it comes to consuming content, books specifically, do you personally prefer written or audiobooks?
You know, honestly, I've got no preference.
Okay.
For how I consume books. I always have one written and one audio going at a time.
Nice.
Sometimes two audio, so like in one fiction and one nonfiction, but yeah.
Okay. I have a bone to pick with you. I was reading your book, or I was acquiring your book, and I couldn't find an audio version. Yeah. I couldn't find an audio version of the book, but I must not be writing looking in the right place.
The irony in that.
Yeah, you would think, huh? I actually did the first, I don't know, 5 or 6 chapters in audiobook while I was still running the company.
Yep.
We had created a division that made audiobooks, and in fact, had created some software. There was a product called Recordio that let people make their own audiobooks, and it was going to be amazing, but. We were developing it right around the time that I ended up selling the company.
Mm-hmm.
And so that project fell by the wayside and I got distracted with other things. You know, basically it's, I'm so sorry. There should be an audiobook. It should have been pre-released as audiobook. I'm embarrassed by this. So I will fix it as soon as I can. Thank you for being like the 40th person who's told me.
That's
ironic.
That's right? Good. Yeah. See, and this is a reason why I say that these, these rapid fire questions are not so rapid, because we tend to kind of
go off on tangents.
Right. No, but it's good. It's fun. What is the best book or one of the best books that you have either read or listened to recently? It could be within the past 6 months, past year, or overall ever.
Well, yeah, it's a lot easier for me to answer the overall than it is to answer the more recent one. Although, oh no, I can think of the most recent one. Most recent one is Sapiens. Okay. And basically the history of human civilization or society, and a chapter in particular, and this was in print form that I read it. No, I take that back. Here's an interesting thing about audiobooks. In your memory, you can't tell if you listen to an audiobook or read it on paper. It feels exactly the same for recollection. But yeah, I listened to this one on audio. And there's a chapter on happiness. I think it's chapter 19 towards the end of the book. I photocopied that or made a PDF of it and sent it to everybody I know, because it talks about the three ways of achieving happiness. And it's it is phenomenal. It kind of rocked my world. So anyway, that I hope there's a follow-up question on that. But yeah, Sapiens. Everybody should read Sapiens.
Not for myself.
Maybe. Well, what are the like, if you can quickly recap that, you said there's three pillars to happiness?
Yeah. So one of them is direct injection of happiness. So we're going to go with heroin. Okay. But things that directly manipulate your brain chemicals. Right.
Like dopamine?
Like dopamine, yes, exactly. Yeah. Dopamine. Serotonin, that kind of thing.
Okay.
There's achieving of what is it? Having a baseline existence that keeps you alive, right? Mm-hmm. So, but this is a very small portion of happiness, especially in the Western world, right? So once you've got a salary of 70,000 and food over your food and then a roof over your head, you're pretty good. But the third one shocked me, which was having a strong belief system and living according to that belief system all by itself. This is why people in the Middle Ages, religion made them happy, that they really strongly believed in it. They lived according to it. Nowadays, if you're a Trump supporter, right? And you surround yourself with other Trump supporters and you only watch Fox, I don't even know if Fox is pro-Trump these days, but if you only watch pro-Trump rallies, then you're going to be happy. No matter how deluded or not you might be, and maybe, I don't want to make a judgment on that being in Canada, but you guys are in Canada, right?
Yep.
Yeah. So I can say whatever I want about Trump. Okay. But having a belief system, and this is why, say, people who are believers in cults or in the mainstream religions are really happy, because it doesn't matter if what they believe in doesn't jive with reality. It only has to match up with what the people around them believe in. So there isn't this constant dissonance between what they believe and what they hear. That has profound implications for how you live your life, right? And why you shouldn't surround yourself by naysayers, right?
Absolutely. Anyway.
Well, no, it's I'm actually glad we sort of organically went there. It's something I've been thinking a lot about recently. I've been consuming a lot of content from Jordan Peterson. I don't know if you're familiar with Jordan Peterson.
I do, yeah.
And I'm sort of digging into some of his biblical lectures and stuff like that. And I think that atheism isn't a great word to describe what the camp that I live in. I don't think I know where I stand in that whole thing, but I've definitely never been religious per se. But I've been thinking a lot recently about that exact point. About I look at my life and all my peers and colleagues, and the ones that are most anxious and depressed don't really have that core belief system, and I'm not taking even a stance, but I'm very fascinated to dig into that deeper to understand why, and why that religion has driven purpose for some of these individuals. So it is extremely fascinating. I'm glad we sort of touched on that.
Yeah, and I'm actually I don't know if you call it agnostic or atheist. I certainly don't follow any of the major religions.
Yeah,
but having read this, now I understand why people do, totally. And why they resist coming out of it.
Totally.
So,
yeah. Awesome.
Awesome. And sometimes we get deep on the argument. last question for, again, you know, these quote unquote rapid fire questions. Arguably one of the more important ones. Are you ready just to get started, get into the meat and potatoes of it, and start talking about some failures?
Absolutely. All right.
Excellent.
Yes.
So I guess I can kick this off a little bit. I have a little bit of context having read some of your book, and one of the things that fascinated me sort of about your early days was that obviously there was some heavy influence from your parents and that sort of culture that you grew up in to, you know, go to school and get a good job. That was very important to them, and I'm sure in some way, shape, or form you're influenced by that. And you sort of, it's an interesting story about your early days, because you went to New Brunswick for your undergrad, and then you got your master's at UBC, and then you even did an MBA at Cornell afterwards. But each step or each new post-secondary institution in your life was also counterbalanced by, well, you know, you were always hedging your bets, but it seemed that you were never afraid of risk. So you started the video delivery company, but you hedged your bet with Nortel, was it?
Yeah.
At the time.
Yeah.
And so each sort of step was taking a more enormous amount of risk, but hedging it with something. Whether it was a really great job,
yeah,
or a degree. Can you talk a little bit about sort of your thought process in that, and where those influences came from?
Oh boy, you know, I feel like this is the kind of thing I should be talking about with my therapist, right? this is delving deep.
Yeah.
You know, because as you're giving those examples, it occurred to me that there was a hedge I made, major in college, which was electrical engineering. I was way better at computer science than electrical engineering. And I just found it easy for me. And it felt like if I took that easy path, that I'd be missing out on something. Like it was just this, somehow this background feeling that jumping into something I loved, that I was really good at, was a bad idea. And that I should go into something which was gonna be pretty good, that I needed to learn at. And then the hedge in this case was computer science, because comp sci, I took those courses in electrical engineering, aced every one, and always had that, you know, my summer jobs, I would always get engineering jobs, but doing computer science. So I felt like now I had two things I was good at. And yeah, you're right, that kind of hedging continued throughout my career. Now, the only thing I can't say, so here's a problem with talking about failure. Is it worked out, right? So whatever I did in the past has resulted in a pretty nice situation now. So it's hard for me to go back and say that was a mistake, because it led to the success I have now. I can theorize, but you know, as a investor now, if an entrepreneur came to me and said, I'm starting this business, I'm hedging it by keeping my Fortune 500 job, but don't worry, I'm really focused on this new business, I'd say, get out of my office.
Yep.
So how is it that my own personal philosophy it isn't what I use to evaluate people now? I don't know. It's, but you know, the two major successes I had in my life, the entrepreneurs in both cases, I was an investor in both cases. I wasn't the guy who started the company.
Which were those?
A company called FuseNet and a company called, well, Simply Audiobooks, which became audiobooks.com. In both cases, the entrepreneur came to me and wanted to hedge his bets, said, I've got this other job, or I'm going to do this part time. And I said, how much money do I have to give you to make you quit the hedge and do it full time? And gave them that amount of money, forced them into it full time, and there were massive successes. So, and then joined both of those companies. in full time, in fact, when I did join those companies, and they seemed to, they worked out.
Yeah, well, you say, I don't know what it's called. Is it the foreword in a book? Is it?
Mm-hmm.
Preface,
forward.
Preface, yeah. In that, you talk about how the contradictory nature of talking about failure, right? Can you just elaborate on that for listeners?
So I mean, one of the things I'm fond of telling everybody is the reason you don't learn enough about failure is because the people who failed typically don't get invited to a podcast like this, right? Don't have the opportunity to say, you know, what's really good is like working at McDonald's. I love McDonald's because it's really hard to fail here, right?
Yeah.
Which is what, you know, what happens after you flame out in spectacular fashion. And there's this feeling, you know, if I tell you to do X, like, don't go to business school, right? You shouldn't go to business school. And that is a piece of advice I have, by the way, don't go to business school. There's very specific reasons to get an MBA, but most people don't do it for those reasons. And I don't expect that you're gonna listen to me. Like, who the hell follows advice from their parents or some entrepreneur on how they should live their life? But the thing I say in my forward is, this advice isn't to make you avoid those mistakes. You're going to make mistakes.
And you need to.
You make mistakes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you need to.
You'll learn from your own mistakes. It's just that when you make the mistake and you think, oh yeah, this other guy made the same mistake and it turned out well for him, you'll just feel less bad, right? I think people like reading stories or hearing stories about failure. And that's why you guys are so popular.
Yeah.
That they like hearing because it makes them feel happy.
Sorry, you broke up there, but it said, you said that it makes...
Yeah, it makes people who feel better because they realize they're not the only one.
Right.
They're in it together with all these other people who are failing.
Right. Mm-hmm. So then in your early days, one of the things we were talking about on the way here was how it never seemed like... correct me if I'm wrong. At least in the few beginning years... There was nothing that you were super like you fell into this problem and that's why you started the company or got into it. You sort of just saw an opportunity and it was, you know, while you were working or while you were in school. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, what inspired you to actually start some of those ventures? So the video delivery company, for example, I remember your in the book you said that your professor told you that it couldn't be done. Was that one of the reasons why you
was that a motivating factor to be like, okay, you say I can't do it, I can do it?
No. I think back to that conversation many times.
Yeah.
and that's just more evidence that he had more evidence that it was a bad idea than I had evidence that it was a good idea.
That it was a good idea. Right.
But you know, I wasn't gonna listen. I was gonna do what I wanted to do. You know, in terms of what projects to follow, typically everyone was a problem that I personally could identify with, but it wasn't, say, necessarily a passion problem. It was just somebody would say, hey, you know, why can't you, why are audiobooks so expensive, right? And why is it so hard to find them? It's like, yeah, you're right. I listen to audiobooks. I had a 2-hour commute each way, 4-hour commute each way to Cornell from Toronto. I used to listen to audiobooks. I burned out the tape player in my car and was spending way too much money on these things. And so when somebody came to me and said, hey, here's the way to make them cheaper and more universally accessible, it's like, all right, that's a problem I have.
Right.
And so I, even today as an investor, I want to invest in problems I have because as a consumer, I know there's no solution. If somebody comes to me and says, you know, we really need blockchain to make digital currency trading easier, it just goes like right over my head. I know what blockchain is. I know what digital currency trading is, but I don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not on the web searching for ways to do it efficiently. So I can't take the entrepreneur's word for it being a good idea. Now, it's funny, in this particular case, I bring up this one because an entrepreneur pitched me on it yesterday. I love the entrepreneur. I've invested him with him before. He made me money. So he gave me the like, talk, here's what it is. I asked him the questions only so I could learn a little bit, but I already knew I was going to invest in his company. And it wasn't based on what he was doing other than, yeah, blockchain. I think that's kind of, probably kind of hot. It was investing in him. And I know I'm going to make money on this one. So yeah, understanding the problem is why I started businesses. But I'm going to throw in one more generic piece of advice here. Yeah. Is the whole idea of following your passion.
Yep.
Following your passion is bullshit. People should not follow their passions. Mm-hmm. Follow something that you're interested in, where there's an opportunity, right? And it'll become your passion, right? All of these kind of
that was the analogy that he had.
That's yeah, that's exactly like Chris was saying. We were talking about this actually on the way into the studio this morning, and during our discussion, we're like, yeah, it sounds like, you know, maybe not. Now knowing that you have personally identified with some of these problems, but I'm like, it more sounds like to me at the time I was saying to Chris that these were, you know, personal interests because you probably identified with the problems and you did, and then, you know, then they become a passion. It's not like you were just saying, like they weren't passion problems or situations that you were trying to solve because you were passionate about them. I think for anyone listening, that the passion does develop over time.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think it's important to maybe define what we're talking about. Like, what is a passion? Mm-hmm. Genuinely, I've felt like I've always known that I was going to be an entrepreneur. I've literally done nothing else. It's like, it feels like the only gear that I have. I don't know if that's a passion, like you said, so much more as an interest that became passionate about it.
Yeah.
Well, this is interesting because I'm now immersed in a world where entrepreneurship is cool.
We talk a lot about that.
Yeah, it's like that wasn't the case 30 years ago. Yeah. 30 years ago, it was like any reasonable parent would say that I'm throwing my life away. So I was caught in that crossfire between my parents saying, go get a real job, and my father being an entrepreneur. Right. And so was it a passion? No. I ended up being an entrepreneur. Honestly, part of it was people expected that I would end up this way. I certainly expected it of myself. Maybe yourself, Chris, that it's, you know, you always knew you were going to be an entrepreneur and that's all you've done. Mm-hmm. For me, I couldn't hold down a job. And that's actually what it was for my dad as well. He got fired. He couldn't get a position. He couldn't listen to people. That's me. I've done well in my Fortune 500 jobs, but would always get, I've been fired 4 times and I'm not making this up. It's like I was fired because I would argue with management. So the only way to solve that was to be management.
Right.
So my passion, I'm going to go with, is freedom, right? Being able to do what I want to do. And now that I have more freedom, I'm loving it. Like, this is great. It's the thing about having made some money is, a guy sent me a link on WhatsApp this morning for this music festival in the Caymans next February. It's called Kabu, I think. Yeah, Kabu. And it's phenomenal. It's like the headline music were Chainsmokers, Duran Duran, and Zedd. Okay? And if you had asked me last night, who you would just instantaneously go to a concert for, it would have been those three guys.
Yeah.
Three musical acts. So first I checked the actual website because I thought it was like an April Fool's type joke, this idiot sending me this thing. And then it's like, no, it's real. And I was able to, I don't have to check the price. I don't have to check anything else. Like, check the dates real quick. And then,
yeah
I'm on it. Like that kind of
freedom. And then pull the trigger. Yep.
And pull the trigger. That kind of freedom is just, like, say it's priceless, but it's not priceless. I can tell you exactly how much it costs.
Yeah. No, it's interesting, and to take a step back, because I'm always trying to, what do you call it, deconstruct mm-hmm. the reasons why I do things, that the people around me do things. Obviously, all of our why our guests do the things they do. Just because I'm fascinated about it. Hopefully, other people are interested in it. And one of the things you say in your book, I don't know. I think you were quoting somebody about you're either your dad's an entrepreneur or something else, and it's like 80% of the equation.
It said. Now, and so it was a little bit politically incorrect, but this was 30 years ago, where it was a questionnaire of all the things that would make you a successful entrepreneur. And
what isn't politically incorrect these days?
Well, because you can't now say that your father is an entrepreneur. It has to be your father or your mother. A close relative or something like that. You want to try and expand that thing. But honestly, the way people react to their father's influence versus their mother's influence is very different. Mm-hmm. Although I suppose in a case where a mom is an entrepreneur, she does become that influence. It's just, unfortunately, it's less common. When you have that strong parental figure who's an entrepreneur, that makes you think, hey, it's okay, right? It's okay to be an entrepreneur because here's this person who's my life, who is one. And that's just not true for a lot of people.
Yep.
I saw it in my first marriage where my wife's parents were both bankers mm-hmm. and she never accepted the risk, like just was not comfortable with the risks I was taking on the entrepreneurship side. And a big, big component of what led to the divorce.
Yeah, it's really tricky. My mom may or may not be listening to this right now, but my dad was is an entrepreneur.
And, okay, well, there you go.
Right. Yeah, it's like super interesting to think about that. And my mom doesn't have that gene or whatever. And definitely there's like, you'll get a job. She was the one that made sure I got a bullshit sociology degree and, everything else.
I love it.
By the way, can I comment on that
please,
for a second?
Please.
Be this guy who was very opinionated on things like, that's a bullshit sociology degree. And I've come to realize that those kinds of degrees are actually incredibly valuable because the skills they teach you are in many ways more valuable than the skills I learned in engineering. Which is being able to get along with people, understanding motivations, is way more powerful than understanding, why amperes and volts flow through wires. And it wasn't until I started understanding people better that I started having these successes in my life. Developing
that's interesting.
Interpersonal skills and being able to put someone else's shoes. Massively powerful
empathy.
Empathy. It's not just empathy. Maybe I'm defining it incorrectly, but in my mind, empathy is the emotional, putting yourself in the other person's shoes.
Yep.
Actually thinking, why is that person doing what they're doing? Mm-hmm.
At that given time, yeah.
You're being cut off in traffic to think, instead of thinking, thinking,
yeah.
That person's in a hurry. Why are they in a hurry? Mm-hmm. Maybe, mm-hmm. The husband's having a nervous breakdown or the mom's in labor or something like that. It's like, say that to yourself and you're done. Like all of a sudden the emotion goes away.
Yeah.
But again, back to sociology or the arts in general, learning how to interact with people is what you go to university for.
And that I would 100% agree with you on. And I think that my only rebuttal to that is that I didn't learn any of that in the classroom. The act of actually going through the motions, and maybe that's just because I'm a shitty student, which I can own up to. I just didn't have the attention span for, philosophy and shit.
But you and me both.
Yeah, but I did. I learned all of that. Having to move away from home for the first time ever, I'm an introvert that grew up in Caledonia, Ontario. So. this is my first, experience to other humans. I can totally agree. What degree do you have again? Something useless also?
Mine is, mine's biology and psychology.
Yeah.
So I was one of those people, when you're on the verge of
deciding to go to university or going to university, I just went the direction and the path of something I was good at. Science, biology, you know, never did any work. Always got, you know, high marks, 90s in high school doing it. So I was like, yeah, this is probably what I'm supposed to do, or maybe I'll start to like it more because I'm good at it. Sure enough, that was definitely not the case. Probably the furthest thing. Now, there were a lot of things that I enjoyed while I was taking that, but probably by like my third year in university, I said to myself, like, this sucks. Like, I don't like this. I don't like this stuff. But I was so committed to my degree at that point that I was like, you know what? I might as well finish up, get this degree.
But you got to get the piece of paper.
Exactly. That's what I was there for. So I got the paper. But yeah, you know what? I agree, Sanjay. Like, I did learn a lot of valuable lessons, whether they were in the classroom directly or outside of the classroom. I mean, I wasn't in class much. to be honest, so definitely, right. Definitely more lessons learned outside of the classroom.
Two of us are great spokespeople for post-secondary education,
right? Yeah. Sure.
Yeah, maybe we are.
You are. You both completed your degrees, right?
Yep.
And now things are going well. So yeah. I know lots of people who didn't. You know, one of the, again, your pet peeves about people when they're advertising for jobs. And they list all the, here's the experience, right. You need, here's the degree, you need all this stuff. It's like, all of that is BS.
Yeah.
the two best developers I ever had, and I've worked with a lot, were both Waterloo dropouts.
Yeah.
Because they just couldn't take it anymore. That they knew more than their professors did, and having to show up in classes. And they both left with a semester left to go, right? Just as a kind of a final FU to the school.
Yeah.
And they make more than most of their colleagues at similar ages now do, because they're so damn good at their jobs. But yeah, I tell everybody, you know, you got to stop advertising for these bullet point requirements, because they're not relevant to how somebody does in their job. It's like, meet with them, see, get references, see how they tackle problems. Anyway, yeah.
Exactly.
No, and that's certainly, unfortunately, I don't have any corporate experience necessarily to sort of echo that point, but it's definitely true in your corporate careers, as I can only know through your book, but you moved up a lot very fast. By the age of 30, you were in a director position, and all of those sounds like just was based on building relationships, and the sort of to what you were saying earlier about things started to happen once you better understood those interpersonal
people,
relationships and people. Yeah. It was very indicative to your sort of success in the corporate world.
Yeah, you learn these, I don't know if you can call them verbal tics, but I was just talking to a buddy of mine the other day. If he's listening to this, he'll recognize himself. he was talking to this girl, and she was saying certain things, and he said, wow, you know, she really thinks the same way I think. Mm-hmm. And I looked at like this chat conversation. I said, dude, she's using these verbal mannerisms that make you think that, but it's actually not true. And it's things like, saying, oh, I was just about to say that, or you know, I was just thinking that, or I was just gonna tell you that, like, so you're catching up on the conversation, but if you're acting like you're ahead in the conversation. And this is, I don't know, just a funny preface to what I was really wanted to say, which is I learned that in job interviews, the first question you should ask is, what would it take to be a star in this position? Or tell me about somebody else who's really good at this. What do you admire about that? And then you just repeat that back over the course of the next half hour, right? And I would get any job I interviewed for. I would get it just because somewhere. So if whoever's out there listening, if you, one piece of advice I can give you to improve your life when you need someone else to do something is ask them what kind of answers. This is hilarious. Say, what would you want me to say? And then just say it.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, just repeat it back over over and over.
Yeah.
And you've won.
And that's that was a product of many frustrations throughout your corporate days, because every time you'd get a performance review back, it would be oh, just keep trucking or whatever. And and there was no actionable feedback. Now, if we can just take a little bit of a fast forward, one of the pieces about your story that I was super fascinated about, and I was sort of left on a cliffhanger, which I thought might be interesting to get you to finish here, was, was it Novatel, the company you were working for, that sort of was a product of you wanting to start a, your own company again, and you had this idea for the mobile email transmitting through a device, and you so you did that through Novatel, and you sort of ran that arm. And then the cliffhanger I was left on was, holy shit, did Sanjay just invent like the BlackBerry? And you you got called into Jim Balsillie and Mike Lazaridis's
Lazaridis.
Okay. Oh, I know, this is my old bricked 9900.
One of Chris's actually he's decided that he's going to go back to BlackBerry. He's ditching iPhone or
I used to be a I got the Google Pixel.
Right.
I used to be a huge proponent for BlackBerry, and I'm actually fascinated by that story. If you know Jim now, I would love to interview him on the podcast.
I would, unfortunately I don't know him well enough to have that conversation, but I would love to meet him at a cocktail party and just say, hey Jim, you remember that conversation that we had 20 years ago or whatever it was now? That'd be fun recollection.
Sorry,
I guaranteed he'll remember it. He'll remember that conversation if it comes up. So
So for Christian and the listeners, can you do a little bit of a recap on what that was, and then where that ended up?
Yeah, sure. So what happened was, I was working for a different company, not Novatel, but I was working for a company that made data modems. So just things that you could plug into the side of your laptop, and your laptop could then communicate with the cellular network, and you could send and receive email on your laptop. But there wasn't, I mean, those data modems were huge. There was no way to use that in a mobile way. But right around then, the Palm Popular, and it happened that this modem was the exact same size as the Palm Pilot in terms of like width and height. And so I figured out a way to just basically strap the two together, put in a power supply, hack the software on the Palm Pilot, and all of a sudden, bam, you're receiving and sending email on a Palm Pilot. People who saw it were just blown away. I showed it to the head of US Robotics, which was Jeff Hawkins, who developed the Palm Pilot, blown away. It's like, what can we do to make this successful? Except back then, in 1996, people saw it as like, this is cool, but it wasn't like, this is necessary. Like, this is something that's going to change the world. Same way as like cell phones when they came out, people didn't like, they thought this is cool, but it wasn't, nobody predicted what happened next. But as we were developing this thing, I got into a fight with the company. Well, I left the company I was with to start a company, didn't do well, Novatel held me out. So then I started developing it with them. And then while I was developing it, I needed salespeople who knew the realm of mobile data. Mm-hmm. And I tried to poach somebody from Research in Motion, BlackBerry. That guy told his boss, who told Jim Balsillie and Mike Lazaridis, who then called me up and said, dude, stop poaching our people. But all they made was pagers at the time.
Right.
And these data modems, they made the modems, but they were just data transfer for somebody else's laptop. They called me in, I showed them the device, they both looked at each other and said, hey, we'd like to supply the modems for your device. Do that. And 2 years later, they developed text-based paging, which was absolutely the predecessor to email on a phone. I didn't invent the BlackBerry, but
maybe you influenced that.
I'll take credit for it. If you want. I'm not going to argue with you.
I kind of figured that's the way the story was going, but I'll give you credit. We'll give you credit.
Well, yeah, we'll give you credit for that.
Yeah, no, we got to the part where eventually, because I was fired from Novatel, the product was developed. It was being distributed. It was an enterprise product. So I think warehouses used it to send like companies use it to send messages back and forth between field staff and corporate staff. And the company went public, and on the basis of that product. And
wow.
Wow.
I several times in my career. So I think in some ways I just felt that it was inevitable that it would happen eventually, but mm-hmm. that was one of the times that I owned a lot of stock in that company. So, and
so what was the story behind you getting fired then from Novatel in that instance?
Yeah, well, the CEO had told me that that he was retiring soon, that he was going to be picking his successor, and that it was going to be me. Because mm-hmm. he lived in Phoenix, I lived in San Diego, and the head of engineering, who was the other potential person, was in Calgary. And the head of engineering was a pretty powerful guy himself, also very had a big ego like I did. But I had the CEO's ear. And so I wanted to hire somebody one day, and the head of engineering vetoed it. And I was like, who are you to veto my hire? I'm in the US, I run the US organization. Head of engineering, you know, payroll goes through my part of the company. I don't like the guy, I don't want him. And it turned into a pure ego battle. And we both ended up, it escalated way too fast. And we both ended up saying to the CEO, I want my way. I want the other guy fired, or I want my way. You rule on it. The head of engineering said, if you go with Sanjay on this one, I quit. And he was absolutely necessary to the company, and I wasn't, because all of my IP had already been signed over to Novatel. Mm-hmm. And I don't regret that. That wasn't the dumb part of what I did. The dumb part of what I did was not empathize and not understand why the other guy was doing what he did, and also backing the CEO into a corner where mm-hmm. he had to make a decision when I didn't have to, you know. Like, I started playing poker after that, and understanding that you need to really understand what that is. It's not what you have, it's not what he has, it's what he thinks you have. And I accurately assessed that. And that was it. My dad, man, did I learn a valuable lesson. Mm-hmm. It cost me probably $20 million. But wow. But in the end, it made me more than that. So it's cool. It's all good. It's good. It's all good.
It's all good.
It's
20 million.
It's a net gain.
Yeah, that's why we do this. I love those stories. Do you still have some time? I'm just being conscious of we're 5 minutes to 12. Do you still have a couple minutes?
I apologize for being a little bit late getting going, but if we could finish up in the next 5 or 6 minutes, that'd be great.
No worries. I guess then to sort of end off on a little bit of an anecdote, mm-hmm. between the 97 and then sort of the audiobooks exit, is there any juicy, you know, failures after that point that really stand out to you that we can talk about?
Well, some of the stuff, like in the book, I had to change a few names.
Yeah, of course. Right?
Mm-hmm. And the absolute juiciest failures have to do with the names I changed, right? Because these aren't stories that people want floating around.
Right.
But I guess without revealing the names, this was one of the times I got fired. And this time I got fired because I just thought a lot of myself. I wanted to do some, I was COO at Simply Audiobooks at the time. Mm-hmm. And everybody reported to me. But I was a little bit bored. The company didn't seem to be going anywhere. And I got involved in a side project. And the board eventually found out about it and told me to stop. And again, this is like, I can do this if I want to. I mean, I'm the biggest shareholder. I started this company, or almost started this company. Who are you to tell me what I can and can't do? And it eventually led to me being fired by the board, left in shock that it had happened. In many ways, the best thing that ever happened to me, because it left me free to pursue that other company, which turned out to be a pretty big success as well. And But in the meantime, I was so angry that I sued them for firing me. And I learned about this legal corporate principle that everybody should know who, if they're a significant shareholder in a company. It's called shareholder oppression. And if you own more than 10% of the stock of a company and they try and screw you over, and this is exactly what happened to Eduardo Severin with Facebook,
right?
Where they tried to dilute him out of his share of Facebook. When you sue somebody for this particular offense, it's a criminal charge, not a civil charge. And it scares the bejesus out of directors of any kind of company, because they're personally liable. There's no D&O insurance that protects you against a criminal charge.
Right.
So while in the end it was completely irrelevant, because what ended up happening with the audiobooks company had nothing to do with me being fired or the lawsuit or anything else. It was one of those points in life where I could have become bitter and really, you know, withdrawn into myself. And this empowered me to take action in a case where I felt I'd been hard done by. So, you know, I say the anecdote because everybody should know this, and hopefully, you know, the art of the fail. It's like if you failed and then somebody tries to screw you over, go talk to a lawyer. Don't talk to a lawyer. Sometimes they actually know what they're doing.
Yeah.
No, that's interesting. That's interesting. I'd never heard of that before.
Yeah.
That's cool. Okay, awesome. Thank you so much, Sanjay. Last question before we have you go. If there was one person, maybe you know them, maybe you don't, that you would call out to share their story on the art of the fail, who would they be? Something maybe that you're interested in learning about yourself.
You know, the hardest thing, Chris, is the hardest part of answering that question. There's lots of people I would love to have talk about their failures,
but they're not there comfortable.
Really, yeah, they're just really, but I've talked to them to say, hey, tell me what happened here. Tell me why you did that.
Right.
Hoping to get a true failure story, not one of these backhanded failure stories. Out. And it's just, all these names pop to mind that when they talk about their failures, they always couch them in terms of success. So I'm gonna have to get back to you.
Okay.
let me think about it.
Well, that must be good then. Okay. Well, thank you so much, Sanjay, for spending some time with us today.
Yep. Thank you, Sanjay. Right. Appreciate it.
And I'm sure the listeners are gonna really enjoy this one.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me. This was a lot of fun. I love talking about myself, obviously. So.
Good. I'm glad you had fun.
Awesome.
You
know,
while I was talking to you guys, I looked up a picture of Martin Garrix. Dude,
yeah.
If you wanted like a second career as, you know, like just go. I mean, if you were in the DJ stand, you're 200 feet away from me and you're going like this.
Well, I was going to ask you, because you had mentioned that, you know, that event that's happening in, is it the Cayman Islands, you said? I was going to ask if Chris, a.k.a. Martin Garrix, is going to be there, or I think you said a young Tiesto, too. I mean, if you've got an extra pair of tickets.
Awesome.
All right, you guys.
Okay,
thank you, Sanjay. Appreciate it.
All right.
Thanks.
All right, bye.
Take care. Bye. So for this season, what Chris and myself have done is we brought on an incredible sponsor, and, well, to be honest, the main reason for that is because we're broke and we wanted more money.
Yeah, what do you think we do this for? Of course, you know, I like hanging out with you, buddy. I like hanging out with you. I like bringing on the guests, but we're entrepreneurs. Get with it, right? We got to monetize this bitch. So we brought on a kick-ass sponsor, Stones and Hustle. Stones and Hustle is the ultimate lifestyle brand for entrepreneurs and hustlers of all shapes and sizes. So first of all, if you haven't checked out the video podcast on YouTube, where you been, go there. Okay. Go check out The Art of the Fail on YouTube. And then you'll see some amazing threads that we've been wearing all season long. We got t-shirts, we got hats, and you can get that and join the movement at stonesandhustle.com. Stonesandhustle.com. Get your gear, join the movement, and keep hustling.